I must say you're gluttons for punishment. Some learn from their mistakes, but you've all come back. I can't help it. Here's what I intend to do tonight, a little different tonight, shorter lecture time. And I'm talking about a play most of you don't know. And as a result, I'm going to approach it in a very different way. And then, having given you an overview of the play and made some basic points about it, so you'll be prepared to watch it, then I will take questions. I think this may be the best chance for you to ask questions about whatever. So I'm here to answer questions. So we'll do as you like it. I'm leaving a DVD with Father Ascara. I went searching for a decent As You Like It, hard to come by. Kenneth Branagh, who made The Much Ado About Nothing, made an absolutely dreadful As You Like It, so bad it couldn't even be released to the theaters. He dumped it on HBO and nobody watched, which is a good thing. For no known reason, he set it in the Orient. I think he thought he was being clever. There's a the BBC production is okay, but they filmed it outdoors, and flies keep going in the mouths of the actors, and the wind is blowing. I mean, there are real problems with filming in the actual space, so it has its problems. It's okay, but not great. There is an absolutely dreadful movie to be avoided at all costs. It was the first film done by Laurence Olivier, one of the great actors. He plays the young hero. But the heroine, Rosalind, one of Shakespeare's greatest roles, is played by a late middle-aged German actress who has a thick German accent. I know the play inside and out, and I can't understand a word she says. It's just terrible. Avoid it at all costs. But I remembered years ago seeing a DVD of filming of an actual stage performance at the Stratford Festival in Canada, with an audience there, done in the early 80s, and I tracked it down. It's really quite good. So I'm leaving the DVD of that with Father Ascara, who will show it to you at a convenient time. So you will be seeing As You Like It, but most of you don't know it yet. Two quick reminders. comedy is a structure and a way of a structuring of the action and a way of looking at the world. Its basic conflict is usually social, the conflict between individual dreams and hopes and desires and the necessity of social order. The conflict often threatens happiness on one side or the other or both, the destruction of the possibility of individual happiness or social disorder of a profound degree. But comedy works its way through that and ends with a vision of compromise, renewal, and regeneration, usually expressed in marriage, which is the perfect emblem of it. Which is why, to my mind, almost all romantic comedy is Catholic in a profound way, because the ending with the marriage suggests something sacramental. Comedy is not jokes. Nothing against jokes. I'm very fond of them. Two psychiatrists walking down the hallway. The first says to the other, "You've got to help me with a patient." Second one says, "What's his problem?" First one says, "He thinks he's invisible." The other one says, "I can't see him." Love it. I love it. Two hats hanging on a hat rack. First one says to the second, "I'll wait here, you go on ahead." It doesn't make you squirm a little bit. It's not really good. Now, I made the point, all three of these plays, the three golden comedies, have titles that seem as if they're toss-away titles. Much Ado About Nothing, As You Like It, Twelfth Night, or it has a subtitle more in line with the other two, What You Will. What You Will, okay? Seemingly offhand. The titles are carefully chosen, though. And in order to begin the discussion of As You Like It, I want to talk about a line that actually comes from Much Ado About Nothing. It had to have been in Shakespeare's mind at the time. Don John, the villain of the piece, in the very first scene where we meet him, is talking about his hatred for his brother, that he would rather be a canker in a hedge than a rose in his brother's opinion. And then has a curious line, which is, if I had my liberty, I would do my liking. And there we have, in a way, a key to this play, which is, as you like it, but that has to do with the whole notion of freedom, the free will, making choices. What is it you like, and what is it that you will choose? And how will you decide what is the thing you appreciate most and best, and given your liberty and doing your liking, who will you be? So the title, the seeming toss away, As You Like It, means quite literally, as you use your free will and make a choice to do that which you like to do. Now, on a simple theatrical level, the title simply means, for the audience, here's a play the way that you like to see plays. It obviously is connected with Much Ado and some of the earlier comedies. It's a romance. It's a romantic comedy. It's about young love. All three of the comedies are, okay? So in that sense, it was very popular at the time. Tastes would shift a bit. It's one reason Shakespeare drifted away, but he had other things on his mind. But at this point, the audiences still loved romance, comedies, young love. The other thing it has, and this is most of the play, after the very first act, the scene shifts to the countryside. And this comedy is really a pastoral comedy. It simply means it's set out of doors, in nature, in the countryside. We move away from the city, from that strictly structured social order that has certain limitations but also certain very clear patterns of living, and go out into the freer world of nature. Okay? And pastorals were very popular at the time. So Shakespeare sets most of the play outside in that other world. And what the characters are seeking, what they are doing, and we'll find it in all the characters, is that they are indeed making choices as to what they like and how they will live. What is the world about? How am I going to live in it? What choices am I going to make? And as Don John says, if I had my liberty, I would do my liking. Because we will end up doing what we like to do. The question is, what will that be? I got to pause a moment. I forgot to tell this morning, this afternoon. The performance of Keanu Reeves in the film as Don John is so appallingly bad. Those scenes, first of all, Branagh cut almost the whole role. I mean, it's nearly gone. He just slashed it to pieces, leaving this poor young actor with just a few phrases here and there. The ones you saw were the ones that he chose to use over the others, where he can barely speak. It's just dreadful. The movie had come out. I'd never seen this guy before. I didn't know who he was. I'm saying to people, who is this? Oh, he's a big Hollywood star. I said, well, that's why he was used. The producers, I'm sure, demanded, oh, we put Keanu Reeves in it. We'll sell tickets. He's a big star. Then I read that he's doing more Shakespeare. Having done the film of Much Ado, he decided that he was a Shakespearean actor and he was going on stage. I'm not making this up. Got a call from a friend who is a very successful actor in Canada. And chatting with him, I said, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm going off to Calgary, Alberta. I'm playing Claudius in a production of Hamlet. Some Hollywood star is coming out to do it. I said, what's his name? He said, Reeves, Keanu Reeves? I said, he's doing Hamlet? He said, why? What's wrong? I said, nothing. Nothing. I hear a few weeks later from a mutual friend who said, I got a call from so-and-so, and he just started rehearsals. And he called me and he said, I got to get out of this production. This is terrible. I can't be seen. Can't talk. He doesn't know what he's saying. I got to get out of this production. And the friend said, well, just quit. He said, I can't. I quit my last production. I'll never work again. Can't walk out on two shows in a row. I know what I'm going to do. Time goes by. The show opens. Dreadful, terrible reviews. And somebody else is playing Claudius. So I call my friend and I say, what happened? I don't know. He's in Africa filming a movie now. I don't know what happened. He came back from Africa, finished the filming, called, and I said, well, what happened? Why weren't you? Oh, he said it was a terrible thing. It was after the first week of rehearsal. Went out for dinner and had a fish dinner. And I got a fish bone caught in my throat. I couldn't talk. I said, you're a fine actor. There'll be other work ahead of you. Here's the basic story. The reason I can do this is As You Like It, unlike Much Ado and Twelfth Night, which both have very complex plots, very complicated stories, As You Like It's quite simple, okay? We are in the city, the social order. We're at the court. We have two brothers, Duke Senior, who is the ruler, the good benevolent ruler, and his brother, Duke Frederick. Each of the two dukes has one daughter. Duke Senior's daughter is named Rosalind, one of Shakespeare's greatest creations. Duke Frederick has a daughter named Celia. The cousins are very close friends, have been from the time that they were little girls. Very fond of each other. Duke Frederick overthrows his brother, gains control, gains power, and sends his brother, the rightful ruler, out into the forest. He doesn't exile the daughter because his daughter won't allow it. They're best of friends. Okay? So she is still at the court with her cousin. Two brothers living in the same place. Older brother, younger brother. Father has died. There's a third brother off at school. The older brother has promised to raise his younger brother well, take good care of him, educate him, and is doing nothing. Treats him miserably, gives him nothing, no education, and there are terrible tensions between these two brothers. Our hero, Orlando, and his older, not-so-nice brother, Oliver. What the play begins with is something classic that Shakespeare would have learned from his early youth, seeing the old medieval mystery plays that would have been done in Coventry for the Feast of Corpus Christi, the Bible plays. The last place in England they were done was in Coventry, 1576. Shakespeare would have been 12 years old. His father, John Shakespeare, a devout Catholic on Corpus Christi, would have taken the family to Coventry. And as part of the day's celebrations, they would have seen these medieval mystery plays. One-act plays telling Bible stories. One of the most popular, Cain and Abel. Brothers. The brothers in conflict. So what he does at the beginning of As You Like It is we have two sets of brothers in conflict. Both legitimate brothers. Not like Much Ado, where we have the illegitimate brother and the legitimate. No, these are both legitimate brothers. In one case, the younger brother has usurped the power of the older brother and banished him. The other case, the older brother is not taking proper care of his younger brother and breaking all the promises he made to him and to his father before his father died. Okay? There's the situation. That's basically what's going on. Duke Frederick, who's in power, becomes jealous of Rosalind. She's too popular. His own daughter is fading by comparison. And he exiles her from the court. You're out of here too. You go live with your father in the woods. His daughter says, I'm going with you. I'm not going to stay here without you. They disguise themselves as boys because they're heading out into the world of nature, not knowing what's out there. And they take the fool from the court with them, named Touchstone. And the three of them go traveling to the woods. Out in the woods, we meet Duke Senior, the exiled man, the rightful ruler, who's there with his fellows who have been banished with him, his loyal supporters. They're living in the woods. Most of the play is set in the woods and is a series of delightful conversations. Of course, before they've left the court, Rosalind has fallen in love with Orlando. Okay, so that's the central. But his situation is hopeless. He doesn't know what he's going to do. She's fallen in love with him. He has to flee to the woods. He learns his brother is going to set his little place on fire and kill his brother. We're all in the woods. We all end up in the woods. And Rosalind is in love with Orlando, and Orlando has fallen in love with Rosalind. They meet up in the woods. But, of course, she's disguised as a boy. He doesn't know it's the woman he loves. I'm going to talk about that at length tomorrow. Same thing happens in Twelfth Night, when Viola has to disguise herself as a boy. Standard practice, I'll talk about it at length tomorrow. We're in the woods, he's in love. Rosalind won't reveal herself to anybody, but she sees how devoted this young man is to her, and it becomes her job to educate him and make sure he's worthy of her love. So she convinces him that what he needs to do before he goes back to woo Rosalind, he thinks she's still in the court, he should practice by wooing her. She'll pretend to be Rosalind, and he can show what he would be like or how he would act or how he would woo this. And, of course, he's wooing the woman that he really loves, and she's being wooed by the man. It's very sweet. It's very funny. It's very nice, okay? What we have are characters walking around the woods having wonderful conversations about all sorts of things, okay? There isn't a lot of plot. Also in the woods, a philosopher. He calls himself a philosopher. Be very careful of that. He announces he's a philosopher. His name is Jaques. He's a cynic. He's a philosopher, all right. Everything stinks. The world's crummy. Especially being out here is crummy. The people out here are crummy. Life is pretty crummy. Fascinating character, okay? Doesn't belong anywhere. He sort of associates himself with Duke Sr. and that band, but he's standoffish, then he's part of them. And what we get from him is one of the greatest speeches that Shakespeare ever wrote. We'll look at it at length. You probably know how it begins. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players, okay? One of the great speeches. Everybody knows it if they don't know the play, if they don't know the character. I'm going to look closely at it. It tells us much about the play. That's basically the plot. At the end, what happens, Duke Frederick orders Oliver to go find his brother who's vanished and kill him. Oliver goes to the woods because he knows that's where Orlando is going to kill him. And instead, Oliver, falling asleep exhausted, has a snake wrap itself around him, and there's a lion waiting to devour him. Orlando sees this and says, just what he deserves, and starts to walk away, and then returns and saves his brother. I'll look at that moment. It's a lovely moment. Having been saved by his brother, Oliver repents. There is much talk of conversion in this play. Souls that were lost, that were on the wrong path, turning around and deciding to choose a different path, go a different way. Of course, and everyone can see this coming, he also meets Rosalind's cousin Celia. So we get a second couple. Okay. We have a couple of other couples. I'll mention them shortly. Even Duke Frederick finally comes to the woods to find his brother Duke Sr. and get rid of him, meets an old hermit living in a cave who lectures him about the way he's living, and he converts and decides to go live in the cave with the hermit and turns the court back to his rightful brother. Happy ending, and they all get married. The god Hymen appears and blesses all the marriages. Not much going on, but it's a wonderful full of the fool's jokes, and they're great jokes, okay? He falls in love with a country girl named Audrey. Calling it love is a little polite. He's decided he likes other things rather than the higher love, and Audrey's got him, okay? So they're getting married. There's a poor shepherd who's in love with a shepherdess named Phoebe. She, of course, falls in love with Rosalind, thinking it's a boy. Little head out there. But now here's something of great interest. I want to take some time. Only you can fully understand this. It's been known for a long while, but downplayed. The forest where the play is set is called the Forest of Arden. Shakespeare makes that very clear because Rosalind walks in the second act, having arrived there, and says, "So this is the Forest of Arden." So the audience knows where they are. The name has double ramifications. Number one, Shakespeare's mother's maiden name was Mary Arden. She lived outside of Stratford. She came from a wealthy family that had large properties, and the forest that they owned there was called the Forest of Arden. In that sense, it's a reference to Shakespeare's own mother's home area where she lived. But as important, or even more important, the Ardens were a devout Catholic family. Devoutly Catholic. In fact, Shakespeare's grandfather worked for the Arden family. And Shakespeare's family, the grandfather, and then Shakespeare, William Shakespeare's father, John Shakespeare, also devout Catholic. So that the Forest of Arden, in personal terms for Shakespeare, means a Catholic area. It's his own family history. It's where he came from. And that family history was profoundly Catholic. Second meaning. We indeed have had a court turned upside down where those who were the rightful rulers have been tossed out and supplanted by those who have seized power. It's called the Protestant Revolt, and it's what happened to Catholic England. When indeed Henry VIII, and then his daughter Elizabeth, established the Protestant Church as the Church of England, and those who were Catholic were gone, or undercover, or hidden, or paying a fine for not going to their new worship service, okay? Those who left England to preserve the faith went to France and founded a school to train priests at a place you know of called Douai, from which we get, of course, the Douai-Rheims Bible. Where was Douai located? In the Ardennes. The forests of the Ardennes. So that those who have been unlawfully uprooted, who have had their country seized from them, who have been thrown out and have had to relocate somewhere else, are in the Ardennes, which becomes the place of survival and where troubles are set right eventually, okay? This is hugely important, hugely important. When we get to the Forest of Arden, beginning of Act 2 of the play, we meet Rosalind's father. He's been there for a while. And he's talking about the very nature of the life they are leading there. I'm just going to read this speech to you. Listen to the attitude here of someone who's been treated unjustly by, this is on page 249 here, okay? Treated unjustly, is living in exile, seems to have no hope of returning. This is Duke Senior. It's the first that we're in the Forest of Arden. He's with Amiens, two or three lords, they're foresters, because they have to live that way now. Now my co-mates and brothers in exile, hath not old custom made this life more sweet than that of painted pomp? We're in a better place. We're in a better place. If this is where we must be, this is a better place because here we can live old custom. Okay? Are not these woods more free from peril than the envious court? Here feel we but the penalty of Adam, the season's difference, as the icy fang and churlish chiding of the winter's wind, which, when it bites and blows upon my body, even till I shrink with cold, I smile and say, this is no flattery. These are counselors that feelingly persuade me what I am. Sweet are the uses of adversity. It's one of those Catholic paradoxes, like the friar in Much Ado saying, die to live, to hero, okay? Sweet are the uses of adversity, which, like the toad, ugly and venomous, wears yet a precious jewel in his head. And this our life, exempt from public haunt, finds tongues in trees, books in the running brooks, sermons in stone, and good in everything. I would not change it. The sense of acceptance is just overwhelming. And what a gift to go back to nature, read the lessons of nature, see the beauties of nature. Now, something else going on here, though, that's quite fascinating. The pastoral vision, and it came from the Greeks through the Romans, hugely popular in Elizabethan England, was that you go to the world of nature and it's a beautiful, wonderful place. It's all trees and flowers and goodness and fun and the easy life. Notice the very first thing mentioned by Duke Senior. The churlish chiding of the winter's wind, which when it bites and blows upon my body, even till I shrink with cold. Whew. Shakespeare is going to present a pastoral world that is beautiful. It is nature. It's a gorgeous world in which one can live and thrive and have a measure of freedom and live comfortably, learning from the lessons God has written in nature to instruct us about himself and the world as we find it. And that's what Duke Senior is doing. Okay? The wind blows, it bites him, and he says, well, they're not flattering me. The wind's not telling me I'm something other than I am. This is not pantheism. Out of that pastoral tradition come the green lunatics of today, where nature itself becomes God. There is no God but nature, and people obsess about preserving nature because nature is in and of itself the highest good. Shakespeare is, in many ways in this play, giving a broader range of understanding to the pastoral world and the pastoral tradition. Yes, nature is good. Yes, we can learn from nature. Yes, nature is to be preserved, but it is part of a fallen world. And it's cold. And indeed, we're going to find out, as Oliver does when he comes in later in the play, there are snakes in the garden. That image of the snake is not accidental. We've gone off to the beautiful green world. The Greeks, most of the Greeks, most of the Romans, the other pastoral world, no, it's all happiness and fine and good. Not in Shakespeare's world, there are snakes. And if the snake doesn't get you, there's a lion right behind you. It's still a place of danger. We don't sentimentalize it. We don't pretend it's more than it is. We acknowledge the very real dangers there and something else if we go out into nature. Now, this is our introduction to Jaques. We'll hear about him secondhand before we see him. The Duke says, come, shall we go and kill us venison? They got to eat. He's not an animal rights crazy, okay? Oh, don't touch the animals. We'll make a nice little grass sandwich and spread a layer of leaves on it. And we'll drink water from the brook. But we can't kill the pretty animals. Where I live right now, we're overrun with deer. Deer everywhere. There's some good, sensible people who have gone out and with bows and arrows, and they're killing the deer. Oh, no, you can't kill a deer. That's a terrible thing to do. And then the deer leaps through your living room window. It's happening. Come, shall we go and kill us venison? And yet it irks me, the poor, dappled fools, being native burghers of this desert city, should in their own confines, with forked heads, have their round haunches gored. Isn't it a shame? They live here, this is their world, and I'm going to go, I've got to kill them, but we need some food. Very practical, very sensible, very down to earth. It's the way the world was created. Indeed, my Lord, this is another Lord speaking. Indeed, my Lord, The melancholy Jaques grieves at that, and in that kind swears you do more usurp than doth your brother that hath banished you. He usurped the court from you and your position there. You're usurping here in nature. You've come here and you are ruling over these sweet little animals. And this is their domain. They rule here. You have no business. Okay? Well, come on. Okay. We know that God gave Adam domain over the animals. Okay? He could name them. He could rule over them. Today my lord of Amiens and myself did steal behind him as he lay along under an oak whose antique root peeps out upon the brook that brawls along this wood, to the which place a poor sequestered stag that from the hunter's aim had ta'en a hurt did come to languish, and indeed, my lord, the wretched animal heaved forth such groans that their discharge did stretch his leathern coat almost to bursting, and the big round tears coursed one another down his innocent nose in piteous chase, and thus the hairy fool, much marked of the melancholy Jaques, stood on the extremest verge of the swift brook, augmenting it with tears. That deer is wounded, it's dying, it's at the stream, and of course we're personifying the animal. It's weeping, and it's breathing its last. What said Jaques? Did he not moralize this spectacle? Oh yes, into a thousand similes. First for his weeping into the needless stream. Poor deer, quoth he, thou makest a testament as worldlings do, giving thy sum of more to that which had too much. Then, being there alone, left and abandoned of his velvet friends, 'tis right, quoth he, thus misery doth part the flux of company. The other deer have left it alone. Anon a careless herd, full of the pasture, jumps along by him and never stays to greet him. Another herd goes running by the wounded deer, not stopping. Aye, quoth Jaques, sweep on, you fat and greasy citizens. 'Tis just the fashion. Wherefore do you look upon that poor and broken bankrupt there? Thus most invectively he pierceth through the body of the country, city, court, yea, and of this our life, swearing that we are mere usurpers, tyrants, and what's worse, to freight the animals and to kill them up in their assigned and native dwelling place. Did you leave him in this contemplation? We did, my lord, weeping and commenting upon the sobbing deer. The deer's crying. Jaques is crying. It's all so sad. It's a jungle out there. Why don't you leave these poor animals? That's wonderful. Shakespeare had a sense of how nuts these people could get. And the Duke says, well, let's go kill us some venison. We gotta eat. Okay. It's marvelous. It's marvelous. It's a pastoral world. It's a beautiful world. It is still a world of nature, and part of nature is man, and it's man's domain, and the animals are there for us to. And it's a fallen nature. The snake is there. The lion is there. And Oliver and Duke Frederick both show up there. Fallen man comes into this world. Okay. Now, what's very interesting is throughout the beginning of this play, I'll just do this very quickly. Why do these two bad brothers hate their other brothers? What's the problem here? And what we find out from the beginning is that there is a great deal of envy. What drives this play, and the whole notion of, you know, what do we like? What do we choose? How do we view the world that we're living and what's around us? Much of it is defined by envy. End of the very first scene, Oliver, the evil brother of Orlando, is setting up a wrestling match and calls in the wrestler Charles, who's going to wrestle any comers, and Orlando's going to go wrestle the guy and says, he basically says, I won't mind it if you break my brother's neck. Charles is a champion wrestler, okay? I hope I shall see an end of him, for my soul, yet I know not why, hates nothing more than he. Yet he's gentle, never schooled, and yet learned, full of noble device, of all sorts enchantingly beloved, and indeed so much in the heart of the world, and especially of my own people who best know him, that I am altogether misprized. Why I don't like him because he's so good. And when the rest of the world talks about how good my brother is, then I get reduced because I'm not that good. Therefore, break his neck. Act 1 has a great wrestling match in it, by the way. I mean, Shakespeare was aware of the World Wrestling Federation before it was on TV. He puts a great wrestling match in Act One of this play. Of course, what Rosalind and Celia try to convince him, oh, don't go do it, go. And he said, I've got to go, I've got to test my, that's wonderful, I've got to go test myself, I've got to prove myself, I've got to go in there. And of course, but you know what happens, right? The great, strong, bluff wrestler gets thrown by the good, innocent young man. It's very nice. But all the way through is this notion. When Duke Frederick says that Rosalind has to be banished from court, it's very much the same reason, and the reason is simply this. Her very silence and her patience speak to the people, and they pity her. Thou art a fool. She robs thee of thy name, and thou wilt show more bright and seem more virtuous when she is gone, he says to his daughter. You're paling by comparison. Get rid of the good. Get rid of the best, and the good appears even better. It's envy. The opening of this play is filled with envy. Those who see goodness and want to get rid of it, want to get rid of it because it may make them look bad. Classic human situation. Classic human situation. When we get out into nature, that is dissipated. Because nature is a kind of equalizer. You don't have the social. You don't have quite the same social structures in the forest that you do at the court. Now, I'm jumping ahead. Orlando flees. And the reason he goes is the old family retainer, the old servant that worked for Oliver's father and Orlando's father for years, gets wind of the plot, loves Orlando, and says, your brother's going to kill you. You've got to get out of here. Orlando says, where do I go? Adam says, the old man is named Adam. And he's a good old man. By the way, it's one of the few parts we know Shakespeare played. He played a number of small parts in his own work. He never played a leading role in his own work. But we know he played old Adam, just like we know he played the ghost in Hamlet. Played old Adam. Old Adam says to Orlando, you've got to flee, and please take me with you. I'd rather go into the difficulties of traveling on the roads with you, even at my old age, than stay here with your brother. So Orlando says, you may come with me. Well, the old man has a rough time. An extremely rough time. He's too old to travel. He's traveling anyway. He collapses. He's starving. Orlando doesn't know what to do. And Orlando comes upon Duke Sr. and his men, and they're having their venison dinner. There's food. And Orlando breaks into it, okay? Forbear and eat no more, comes in with his sword drawn. Why, I have ate none yet, says Jaques, nor shalt not, till necessity be served. Of what kind should this cock come up? Who is this creature? Duke Sr. says, art thou thus bold in man by thy distress, or else a rude despiser of good manners, that in civility thou seemest so empty? Why are you behaving like this? Orlando says, you touched my vein at first. The thorny point of bare distress hath ta'en for me the show of smooth civility. Yet am I inland bred and know some nurture, but forbear, I say, he dies that touches any of this fruit till I and my affairs are answered, and it's not for himself, it's for the old man. Okay, it's for the old man. Duke Sr. says, your gentleness shall force more than your force move us to gentleness. Calm down. Quiet down. And they offer him what's there. And then Orlando's embarrassed. And explains, I had to do it for this old man who's dying. They say, bring him here, we'll feed him. Orlando goes out. Duke Sr. says, thou seest we are not all alone unhappy. There's much unhappiness in the world. Don't think you're special. This wide and universal theater presents more woeful pageants than the scene wherein we play. Sparks Jaques, who says, all the world's a stage. This play, maybe, there are two possibilities. We don't know which came first. Opened the New Globe Theater in 1599. Outside the globe was an image of Atlas holding up the world. That was the symbol of the Globe Playhouse that Shakespeare wrote in for the rest of his life. So that what we get here is all the world's a stage. It's the globe. And indeed, the sign outside announcing you're at the Playhouse was Atlas holding up the world. There's this wonderful double ramification going on at that point. I'm going to read the speech. As I said, very famous, very famous. It's on page 264 in the other book. It's Act 2, Scene 7. If you have a different text, Act 2, Scene 7, about line 140 or so, okay? All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. At first, the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms. Then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like snail unwillingly to school. And then the lover, sighing like furnace, with a woeful ballad made to his mistress' eyebrow. Then a soldier full of strange oaths and bearded like the pard, jealous in honor, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice, in fair round belly, with good capon lined, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances, and so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice, turning again towards childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all that ends this strange, eventful history is second childishness and mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. Oh, well, that's lovely. It's a philosopher. He picks up on something, expands on it, and gives a worldview. It's a cynical philosopher. Bleh, bleh. The beauty of the infant in arms, mewling and puking. Okay? The schoolboy with the shining face, okay, creeping like snail, love it, unwillingly to school. Don't make me go to school. I hate it. Okay. The lover, okay, sighing like furnace. Woeful ballad made to his mistress' eyebrow. Nutcase, right? Soldier, full of bearded like the bard, jealous in honor, sudden, seeking the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth, not going out to fight a victory, not going out to assure moral order, as I spoke of this afternoon, going out to gain reputation. Famous fighter, brave soldier, the bubble reputation, gone like that. The justice, okay, his belly, his capon lining, the cut beard, and the wise sayings over and over again. Well, I think, as I have often said, blah, 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 blah. Okay? The sixth thing, the lean and slip, quite literally fading away. The clothes just hanging on the figure that's becoming skeletal with a little pouch on side, trying to save a little money. Why? You're dying, okay? The voice being gone, going up and, it's becoming like this, barely able to talk at all. And finally, second childishness and mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. Ghastly vision. This speech is, high school English teachers make their students memorize this speech. I mean, no wonder teenage suicide's been going up. It's positively grisly. It's horrible. Shakespeare does this deliberately over and over and over again in the plays. What's the next thing that happens? Enter Orlando with old Adam. Sans eyes, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste. Sans. We see our old, old, old man who is devoted, loyal, loving, sacrificing, willing to travel with his young master, endure danger, hardship, hunger, not complaining. Enter old Adam. Jaques is full of beans. And what happens next on the stage contradicts the speech. Very nice speech, nicely put, you're crazy. Look at this glorious old man. There's old age. There's what old age can be if you choose to devote yourself, as this good old man has done, to others, to become self-sacrificing, to be giving. It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. Tell you what, I could go on. I think I've given you the basics. Let me put it this way. The play works out. The bad guys convert, okay? The good guys get back what they had. All the couples end up as they should be. And out of nowhere, the god Hymen shows up. This Greek god suddenly walks into the forest. Well, why not? This Greek god walks into the forest and blesses everyone. And Orlando and Rosalind are united. And Oliver and Celia are united. And Silvius gets his Phoebe, God help him. And Touchstone marries Audrey. And it's wonderful. At the very end, Jaques is sort of giving his final blessing on everybody that's there. And he says to Touchstone, and I leave you and you to wrangling, okay? For thy loving voyage is but 2 months victualled. You two are going to last about 2 months. That's all you got there, okay? And he goes off to find the hermit in the cave to talk with him, because these religious men sometimes have things to tell you. In every one of the Shakespeare's comedies, there is a figure that will not fit into the happy ending. We can say this much. We can say this much for Jaques. He's going to go talk to the old religious hermit because he thinks he can learn something. We hope he does. We hope he does, okay? And at that point, the play ends in true delight and a happy marriage dance. It's a beautiful play. It's a lovely play. A witty play, a charming play. Not as complex in structure, but filled with joy and depth. And Shakespeare's Rosalind is one of the most enchanting, lovely characters he ever wrote. Not strong and forceful as Beatrice was. Feminine in a very different way, but just as feminine, just as lovely. And I hope you enjoy the production when you watch it. You should have some sense now of what's going on in it, okay? Now, we've got about 20 minutes. What I want to do is, is that right, Father? Yeah, okay. Open the floor to questions. Whatever you'd like to ask or talk about, this is probably the one chance that I have to just answer what's on your mind. Yes?
Doctor, I was just wondering about the title, As You Like It. Be seen as in any way as, you know, how you accept God's will?
I think, yeah, the notion of as you like it indeed has much to do with accepting God's will. The speech I read by Duke Sr. I mean, they're in a terrible situation. His point is you accept it. And the whole speech basically says, we will find things here to like. There's much that we can learn from where we are. This has happened to us. Here we are. Fine. Yes, precisely. Whereas many of the other characters, I mean, very clearly, Jaques' whole purpose in living and going about the woods is he doesn't like it. Just doesn't like anything. He's walking vinegar. He's a human pickle, you know, who's just, he's there all the time to just, there is a wonderful scene, you'll see it, I don't want to spoil it, where he's talking with Rosalind and she just, you know, she'll have none of it. She's fresh and young and lively and filled with joy and happiness and life. She will have none of it. It's glorious, too, because we see him just briefly with Orlando. He comes in with Orlando, And they've clearly been talking before they come on stage. And Jake, it's wonderful. He says, I thank you for your company, but good faith, I as lief had been myself alone. Orlando says, and so had I. But yet for fashion's sake, I thank you too for your society. What's fashionable to say we enjoyed you, so I'll say it. Okay. God be with you. Let's meet as little as we can. I do desire we may become better strangers. the dialogue is wonderful. It's just marvelous that way. So, it's non-accepting, precisely. It's non-accepting. There are characters who have to be forced into acceptance. Phoebe, the young shepherd girl, just totally. The poor Silvius is a sweet young doofus. Just duh, duh, duh. Oh, I love her so. Oh, gee. She's so nice that I just love her, you know. And she's this snotty little thing. And you know, there's a great speech where she's fallen in love with Rosalind. Once Rosalind gives her what for? He's a good young man. He's a fine young man. You treat him this way. Rah, rah. Whereupon Phoebe goes, "Oh, I'm interested in this one because you know, it's a verbal beating." So she likes this guy who isn't just moping all over her, but given her what for and told her off. And then she, but the only way Phoebe will marry Silvius, Rosalind says, okay, I will marry you if you want to marry me. And if you say, no, I don't want to marry you, then you have to marry Silvius. Oh, okay. Never think it's fine. And then Rosalind shows up as a girl. Phoebe goes, oh, okay. Yeah, I go, okay. And Silvius goes, yes. Yes, I win. But there's just forced will. It happens everywhere in the play. Yeah. Love filled with song. There is the play is just filled with song, a wide variety of song, which simply lovely. A chance for musicians. It's a it's a musical. Question in the back. Yeah.
Were people at Shakespeare's own audience have understood the reference to the fountain or the forest?
Many would have. They couldn't have, Arden would have jumped out at them. But of course, what he's doing here, there's a book that came out recently that goes into some of the unspoken, hidden things that are in Shakespeare. It's called Shadow Play. Interesting that the woman who wrote it was in the Soviet Union. Her husband was a British diplomat there. She goes to the theater one night, seeing a little play based on a Chekhov short story, and realizes the audience is picking up on things other than the plot of the play. There are buried references in the play having to do with the political situation that the KGB guards at the exits and entrances aren't catching up on. And the audience is going, yeah, I got that, yeah, okay. But they never would have said anything. It wouldn't have been made public. Shakespeare's plays are filled with those things. Filled with them. Not all of the audience would have picked it up. Many would have. They wouldn't have said much of anything. Okay? But they would have known where Will was by the things he said. It's fascinating. It's fascinating. And some plays more than others. But Forest of Arden, they may not have known his background, but they would have known the Ardennes. Because that's where the Catholics went. And that's where the priests came from that came back to England, many of whom wound up executed at Tyburn. Yeah. So they would have been aware of that, certainly. And yet, it's a comedy. It doesn't swamp it. It's there. It's there, but it's not a political play in that way.
On what basis do some claim that Shakespeare didn't write the plays?
Yeah, fair question. Fair question. It's everywhere now. It's epidemic. In his own time, the question was never ever raised. For 150 years after his death, the question was never raised. This nonsense began in America in the latter 18th into the 19th century. It began with a crazy woman named Delia Bacon, who believed Sir Francis Bacon wrote the plays. She was no relation of his. She may have thought she was. She had no evidence other than her own deranged mind, but she went all around and convinced all kinds of people that you, if you're crazy enough and fanatical enough, you can convince others to believe in you. And she convinced people to believe. And she got the funds to go over to Stratford and dig up his grave to prove that Sir Francis Bacon was there, or there were other plays there, or evidence in the grave that Bacon had written the plays. Now, the local authorities said, no, you can't dig up the man's grave. Plus, there's a curse on the grave, written undoubtedly by Shakespeare himself. Good friend, for Jesus' sake, forbear to dig the dust, enclose it here. Blessed be the man that spares these stones, but cursed be he who moves my bones. Grave's never been opened. I think the reason that is on there is it was known in Stratford that Shakespeare died with the last rites of the Catholic Church. He had a priest with him. He got last rites. And I have no doubt he was buried probably with a rosary and a scapular, and was afraid that his family might be attacked by someone digging up to prove he was a Catholic, which could have caused trouble for his family. He didn't promote it. He stayed in the background, okay? He wasn't bold about it. But we know that happened because a Protestant minister who was there when Shakespeare died wrote a letter to a friend saying, "Master Shakespeare died a papist." Just in disgust. So we know it happened. Delia Bacon goes over, they wouldn't let her dig up the grave. So she waits till night, goes in with a lantern, a pickaxe, and a shovel to dig it up on her own. And they haul her out of there, and she's briefly arrested and goes back. That's where it started, okay? Then it spread, and all the other candidates showed up. Christopher Marlowe, killed in 1593 in a tavern brawl. Shakespeare's at the beginning of his career. No, he didn't really die. They spirited him off to Italy, and he sent the plays from Italy. Queen Elizabeth wrote the plays. But since she was a woman, she couldn't do it publicly, so she had to hide behind this nincompoop from Stratford. Current favorite candidate is the Earl of Oxford, who wrote and published poetry under his own name. And it stinks. How odd that you would publish poetry under your own name that's bad while you're writing masterpieces hiding behind somebody else's name. And he died about 6 years before Shakespeare stopped writing. And the last plays of those last 6 years include contemporary references to things that happened after the Earl of Oxford dies. Doesn't stop them. They have no evidence. The so-called evidence is a kid from Stratford with an eighth grade education couldn't have written these plays. Why not? I've said often, I'll say it again, I would trade my PhD for Shakespeare's eighth grade education. He learned Latin, he learned Greek, he got the classics. I got nothing. I got a couple of good English teachers, God bless them. He had a great education. There are others who say, well, he was sort of middle class, and only someone from the aristocracy could have written these plays. But nonsense. God doesn't distribute his gifts that way. God gives gifts where he chooses. There is no evidence. It began 150 years after Shakespeare's death. No contemporary questions. They knew who he was. He knew everybody. They speak about him. There is a good deal of evidence who he was. We have the playhouse records. We've got it all. It's lunacy. Lunacy. But as with anything else, the less you know, the more committed you become. So there are just, you know, hundreds of nuts out there. And when this new film comes out, oh man. Well, just tell them they're all crazy and to go away. Yeah. But anyway, that's the best answer I can give. Human idiocy. That's where it comes from. Yeah. Anything else? Yes.
When considering the direction or interpretation of Shakespeare plays, is there anything besides the obvious that can you point to a good adaptation from the
form? Much of it's taste, okay? Let me tell you, as somebody who spent a lifetime in the theater, I did 120 productions. When you decide to do a play, you want to do your best, okay? You have some vision, you need a set design, you need costumes, you cast it, you try to do what you can. And while you're working on it, you have no idea what you've got. Day by day, it's just hard work, and you have good days and bad days, and you don't really know until it's out there on the stage in front of an audience what you've got. I think most people are sincere. There is a problem now of updating Shakespeare to contemporary times for contemporary relevance. It's awful. I've only seen it work maybe twice. Oddly, one time I saw it work, the best time I ever saw that work, was with As You Like It. A director set it immediately after the Civil War in the South. So you had brother against brother. You had the winning side that had taken power away from those who had been in power. The Forest of Arden was sort of a swamp, hung with Spanish moss. It was gorgeous. At the court, the girls wore hoop skirts and looked like, you know, Scarlett O'Hara. But then when they went traveling, and Touchstone went with them. He was a carpetbagger. I'll talk about the fools tomorrow. The fool changes here. Jaques, who was walking around cynically, looked like Robert E. Lee, wearing his Confederate uniform and a big beard, but not Lee's character. He just looked like, but he was bitter and angry, and man, it worked wonderfully. It worked, you know. But 99% of them I've seen are just terrible. I think the people who did them were sincere. Sometimes you're stuck with casting people who aren't good. You might be interested to watch the BBC Much Ado About Nothing. Very different production, different performance. And just get a sense. There are many, many different... The amazing thing about Shakespeare is he's been done now for 400 years and the plays survive. Bad productions, good productions, rewritten productions, insane productions, brilliant productions, and he just keeps going. The plays are indestructible, and boy, a lot of people have tried to destroy them. So, I mean, some just horribly. The King Lear was not given with its original ending for 125 years. For 125 years, it was a ghastly rewrite by Nahum Tate that had a happy ending. Just a putrid play. Just awful. But that's what held the stage for 125 years. We can't believe it now. You don't know. It's a mystery. It's part of the mystery of art. Yeah. It's a great mystery. Yes?
If As You Like It is simple, beautiful, etc., but not very complex, why is it a golden comedy?
I don't want you to think when I say it's not as complex as the others, that it's not, that it lacks depth. The plotting is not as complex. Okay, let me make a distinction between the story, the plot, and what the play is talking about. What is in the play, the ideas in the play, what's going on in the play is every bit as complex, but it is told with greater simplicity. Okay? Especially now. Well, let me put it this way. In Much Ado About Nothing, the whole question of manhood is in some ways more pertinent to us. Various Shakespeare plays speak to various ages more directly. As You Like It doesn't speak quite as directly, although with the insane green movement out there, I think it has much to talk to us about the wrong-headed views of nature and the natural world, and a worship for nature in and of itself, apart from any recognition of the creator of nature and how sane, devout people should view nature. So it may become more important. Simplicity in and of itself can be as beautiful and rich and deep as complexity. If you take, for example, the Beethoven Hammerklavier Sonata, end of his life, massive, 50-minute piece, unbelievably complex. People can hardly play it. I've only heard it done live twice in my whole life. It is massive, huge, deep, and complex. If I set against that a simple Mozart sonata that's 20 minutes long and rather easy to play, and I call the Mozart sonata simpler and not as complex, I am not making a value judgment. One is complicated, difficult. The other has a simplicity and grace and beauty that is as mysterious and certainly as deep as the Beethoven. Okay? Yes?
Okay. I think maybe the point of the question was more because we said that there are these three comedies are almost impossible to find another comedy of their dignity, so to speak.
Yeah.
But it would seem, for example, that The Merry Wives of Windsor with Falstaff is a comedy that would maybe be more to know.
I'll tell you why. This is very interesting. Perfect example. This is legend, but it's a legend I believe in absolutely. Falstaff appears in Henry IV Part 1 and Henry IV Part 2. Probably written 1596, 97, 98, something like that. Hugely popular character. Audiences love Falstaff. It's one reason he came to him back in Part 2. Shakespeare has him die off stage in Henry V, even though he promised he would be in Henry V. He knew Falstaff would swamp the play. You couldn't focus on Henry if Falstaff was on stage. He would just steal everything. So he dies off stage. The legend is Queen Elizabeth ordered Shakespeare to write a play about Falstaff in love. I believe it for this reason. Merry Wives of Windsor has more prose in it than any other Shakespeare play. There's almost no poetry. Suggesting he wrote it in a great hurry. He may have even had a little joke on the Queen in that Falstaff is not quite the same character he is in the Henry IV plays. He's not as witty. He becomes the butt of jokes rather than being able to handle jokes. There is, it's the only contemporary domestic comedy he ever wrote. It's set in Windsor. He never did anything like that. It's a fine stage piece, but it does not have the depth of these three. Okay? Here's a curiosity. The only artist I know who improved on Shakespeare, the 80-year-old Verdi, took The Merry Wives of Windsor and wrote an opera called Falstaff that is greater than Shakespeare's play. And I would list Verdi's Falstaff as a comedy equal to Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. So Verdi took the raw material that I think Shakespeare tossed off, and he turns that into this magical comedy because of his music. There's very little poetry in the original. Verdi adds this magical music. He's an 80-year-old man, and he had not written a comedy in close to 50 years. He wrote only tragic operas. His second opera was a comedy. He had a contract with La Scala. When he started to work on it, his wife died and his two daughters died. And he went to the management and said, I cannot write a comedy. They said, you have a contract, write a comedy. He agonized through it and he never wrote another one until he was 80 years old. And then when he did, he wrote a masterwork. So these things are mysterious. These things are very mysterious. You know, even Midsummer Night's Dream, which is one of the great comedies ever, just superb, is so different from these three. It's earlier. It comes from a different imagination, from a different time. I love that play. But it's different from these three. These three just boom, 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 one after another. Probably 1598, 1599, and 1600. Just, you know, one a year. And he was doing some other things at the same time. Wrote Henry V at the same time. Was writing Julius Caesar at the same time. Of course, we know it's the one account we have of Shakespeare writing. He never blotted out a line. The person who saw him write. To be or not to be, there's a question whether 'tis nobler. In the mind to suffer slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Or to take arms against a sea of troubles. Yeah. And by how is that possible? It's possible. God can do anything when he gives gifts in abundance.